home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, and welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson, and I want to thank our announcer, Garrett Miller, for providing that intro and also for being essentially the producer of the platform here on Rated G Radio, of which Rated LGBT Radio is the LGBTQ community and news center. And we've got a really important show for you tonight. I think it's got a lot of impact and a lot of relevance. And beyond that, we have a guest roster that should blow your socks off, because these folks are fingers on the pulse of everything that is going on in terms of the white supremacy attacks on America, and specifically the attacks on the LGBT community within their very odd, perverse diversity that they represent in terms of hating people. So we get our hatred along with the racial profiling that they hate, and the religious profiling that they hate, and the sexual orientation and gender identity is right up there with them. But tonight I have on deck, that I will be bringing on in just a minute, the esteemed Brody Levesque, my good friend and seasoned journalist, and he has been the backbone of numerous LGBT publications, as well as just being a top-notch journalist in the field, working with the AP for years and years. And he's going to kind of sit in the co-host chair with me tonight. But also on board is another seasoned journalist that gives Brody a run for his money in terms of expertise and battle scars out there in the field. And that is Karen Oakham, and she is the senior editor of LA Blade. I will be bringing her on in a minute. Also on deck lending their expertise is Will Betts, executive director of Out Memphis, and he is part of the LGBTQI Center in Memphis, Tennessee. I can't wait to talk to him about some of the cultural issues that are surrounding a lot of this, because a lot of this has to do with the Confederacy and the Old South, and that spilling over into today. And also Cynthia Deedle, and I hope I got her name right, is Program and Operations Director for the Matthew Shepard Foundation. So obviously she is very entrenched in the fighting against the hate culture. But she is a former FBI special agent and oversaw hate crimes. And I'm very excited to talk to her about what's going on. I'm actually excited to meet her and maybe do a television show about her life, because I'm so fascinated with all the things she has done and experienced. But without further ado, let me bring on Brody Levesque. Brody, good evening.
Good evening, Rob. Hey, how you doing?
I'm good.
We're an all-star.
Before we bring our panel,
we have an all-star cast tonight.
What's that?
I said we have an all-star cast tonight. We've got
my good friend
Karen Oakham at the LA Blade. We've got my old friend Will Betts, and I'm excited to meet Cynthia, because I'm a longtime supporter of the Shepherd Foundation. I know Judy and Dennis. I was one of the original reporters way back when Matthew was murdered. So it's an honor to actually talk to a member of the foundation. And Jason Marsden, who's the executive director of the foundation, and I are friends as well. And their communications director, Sarah, and I just get along great. So I'm really looking forward to meeting Cynthia.
Great. Well, let's bring them on. And Will, welcome. Cynthia, welcome. And
great. Thank you.
Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
So
it's Cynthia. It's great to be here.
It's great. And Karen can give you guys a little bit of the lay of the land. She is a previous guest, and the fact that she showed up again shows that I didn't do anything too terribly wrong the last time. So welcome, Karen, for your seasoned return.
Thank you.
Visit.
And the quick lay of the land is this is a conversation, and it's a smart conversation, and that's the best part and one of the reasons that I'm back, and I appreciate it.
Well, you brought the smart, so yay. So I really, really appreciate that. So to get started, I'm going to do something actually kind of bizarre, because the Donald Trump response to this whole thing was, by almost every account, off the charts, wrong, weird, and awful. But before we let it go down that track, I want to play devil's advocate on some of the points I think he is trying to make in kind of a bizarre sort of way. And the first point that I wanted to ask you guys about, and Will, I kind of want to focus this on you because I think you are entrenched in the cultural environment where this would make more sense. But
right.
Donald Trump wants to position a lot of this as, there are some folks there that just love those statues, and they, you know, they didn't show up to do anything bad but protect those lovely statues. And that begs kind of a question about some of the Confederate memorabilia and nostalgia of the territory. And this had an impact on me when I was watching Good Morning America with Cokie Roberts, giving commentary to Robin. The thing that she mentioned was her ancestors that, you know, not so long ago, their gravestones mark the fact that they were members of the Confederate Army. And obviously Robin's background is African-American, and how, you know, these cultures have had to try to evolve from this historic past. So here's my question. Is the wanting to hold on to Confederate memorabilia on the part of white people in the South kind of an extreme example of white privilege, that we're wanting to hold on to something that we've known our whole lives, but we never stop to examine what the ramifications might be to other people?
I think that's part of it, but I also think, especially for the South, and white Southerners, certainly, you know, middle class and lower white Southerners, that imagining themselves as something grand and wonderful, this, you know, fight for states' rights or whatever it is that they want to call it, it's some sort of idealized view of how their life might have been back then. And so I think they're trying to I'm going to say we, even though I don't hold those positions, because I'm part of I grew up in Tennessee. This is my home. And we're trying to create this fantasy that's better than our reality. Just as a bit of background, I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is probably the most Confederate rich city in the country. You know, we have events on battlefields, Chickamauga Battlefield, Missionary Ridge. You know, those are names that you know if you know anything about the Civil War. And so that's kind of our life. And part of that is the supposed grandeur of that time. And, you know, I think that's all a fantasy, but I know a lot of people that try to hold on to that because, you know, their real life isn't that great. So I think that's part of it. But I will tell you, I grew up in that life of, you know, I know that I had a Confederate hat when I was younger. I have seen pictures of myself in that. I have, you know, certainly ancestors who were in the Civil War and fought for the Confederacy. So, you know, that's part of my heritage as well. So it's kind of what we breathe down here, right? It's Gone with the Wind, right? It's
totally.
Ashley Wilkson, right? It's like this grand adventure to preserve the grandeur and dignity of the South, which is a load of crap. But that's what we're taught.
Right, right. Well, it brings up my inner Scarlett O'Hara instantly. So, yeah. No, Totally get that. So I've got a question along those lines, though, to everybody on the panel. And so whoever has an opinion, please jump in on this. But one of the things that Donald Trump mentioned, and he mentioned it in a way that, you know, was questioned, and you know, and I get why what he said was essentially very wrong-minded. But I want to kind of play the other direction on it, because it's something that has been bothering me lately as a non-Southerner. And he pulled up George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and said, hey, these guys were slave owners. Why aren't you going after them? And I'm going to bring this up in a cultural context. I was watching the latest Spider-Man movie. And in one of the scenes in that Spider-Man movie had one of the students say, I don't want to go up in the Washington Monument because that was built by slaves. And, you know, took advantage of the slave population at the time. And the movie basically reconfirmed that fact, which it never occurred to me. But isn't it time we start looking at even the northern people who did that and putting more reality to kind of, well, to your point, to our sort of fantasy look at our past history? I mean, There was a lot in the north that we don't give credit to African Americans that were taken advantage of. I mean, isn't it fair to do what Donald Trump was afraid of, that we actually look at everybody?
I'm going to jump in for a second, and then I'm going to defer part of this as a question to Cynthia, because she actually would be our resident expert in this area. As a reporter and as a journalist who's covered the overall and overarching view of civil rights violations and civil rights issues that are directly related to that specific question, I think that one of the things that's overlooked is the context. And the context is that, you know, there seems to be a gloss over of it, that they don't want to accept it. I can remember during the Obama administration when Mrs. Obama mentioned the fact that the White House itself, or at least a shell of it, had been constructed with slave labor. And, of course, everybody on the right lost the plot over that. But I think it has a more far-reaching impact, as we've seen in Charlottesville over the weekend, and that is that it clearly defines, even to this day, it just clearly defines the divisions culturally in there, and then that can translate, you know, into problems in terms of race relations, in terms of relations with the LGBTQI community, women's reproductive rights. So it's more than just a symbology, Rob. I think it becomes an entrenched, you know, thought pattern. I think Cynthia can answer this because, you know, in her time with the Civil Rights Unit at FBI headquarters in Washington, I'm sure in the countless cases that she worked on one of the cold case units, you know, they addressed things like what happened to the civil rights workers in 1964, Goodman Young, and I can't remember the other young man's name, who were killed, and all they were doing were coming down from the north to help, you know, help black people get to vote. And everything was about symbolism. And it still carries over today. And Cynthia, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the state flag of Mississippi still incorporate the battle flag of the Army of Northern Virginia? And I'll hand this off to Cynthia.
Well, thank you for the question. I appreciate it. I have to say that what I always hoped for people is that they would be educated, and whether that means taking a look at the history of our founding fathers or the history of the civil rights movement or civil rights martyrs or what happened in the 50s and 60s in the South. I want people to not just listen to CNN or to Fox News or MSNBC, but I want them to find their own information, and I want them to be curious and questioning and figure out what they believe the truth to be based on their independent research. And I think that that's what I would hope that people would pursue in their own lives for their own truth. And I have to say, Will, that yes, I work for the Matthew Shepard Foundation. I'm very proud to do so, but I'm actually a resident of Knoxville, Tennessee. And I retired from the FBI in Knoxville just a few months ago. And about 6 days ago, I received my license to practice law in the state of Tennessee. So, but I'm not from the South. I was born and raised in Ohio and spent the majority of my life in the Northeast. But I have to agree with you, Will, that it is a lot of pageantry. It's a lot of pride in the South and in Tennessee. And, you know, I have to say, I can't blindly and just generally criticize people in the South for holding on to this past glory and maybe some future hope. And I think people always want to be the winner. They don't want to be the loser, and they don't want to be seen as the loser. And I think there is some sensitivity I think that people need to have and appreciate for Southerners that, you know, are just, they are fans of Gone with the Wind and Scarlett O'Hara, and they're holding on to a past that they want to still believe in. And I don't feel comfortable just blanketly criticizing everybody in East Tennessee either.
Right, right. And Cynthia, one of the, I mean, and I'm serious, I want to make your life into a TV show. Is like,
wow,
I mean, I can just see you running down the street. Yeah, it's like, so anyway, it's fascinating the stuff that you have touched and covered. Actually, everybody on this call should each have their own TV show about them. But anyway, I'm diverting. But could you give us some background with your experience in investigating what I'm going to call the hate infrastructure in the United States? Why, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show about the diversity of hate, this perverse diversity that they have towards, you know, the videos started with them talking about the Jews and the blood in the soil. And then there were videos of the chanting in the park, which was completely homophobic. And one of the instigators that has a warrant out for his arrest in the video about him, he's sitting there crying about potentially being under arrest. And then he mentions Chelsea Manning, and instantly this transphobic hatred just starts bubbling out
right.
of him. It's like this real change of tone in his delivery. And, you know, obviously the biggest thing of their platform is their racial hatred. What is their real target? I mean, who did they really want to get? I mean, they're going after everybody.
Well, I think that's easier. It's easier to say, I hate the Jews, and I hate transgender individuals, and I hate Muslims, and I hate Puerto Ricans. I mean, it's easier to say, I hate everybody except for people that look like me. And I think that's been my experience investigating hate crimes of a variety of bias motivations is you just see pure hatred for someone who's different than the perpetrator. And I think that's what we saw in Charlottesville is I just want to be better than somebody else. So I want to be better and be higher up on the socioeconomic ladder than a Jew or than a Muslim. Or actually, let me group all of them together so I can stand above these 17 other races and classes and genders so that I can be even more prominent than just being above one level of somebody. So I think that's what you saw was just this hatred towards everybody who could possibly be different from them in some way. And it's easier. It's easier than just saying, well, I only hate Jews, but I love Muslims. And transgender is okay too, but I hate the one. It's rare to see that. Usually if you see someone who has a just a vile, vitriolic hatred towards another group of people, they hate another group of people too. And I think that's what I found is, you know, it's not just an equal opportunity hater. They hate a whole lot of people.
So
I would tend to agree with that.
Yeah, I'm fascinated.
Karen and
I
had that conversation.
Yeah.
What I was going to point out was what Cynthia said is Karen, you and I had this conversation when you were discussing the Fuck the Faggot group that were out in the park. And Cynthia and Will, by the way, because this is Blog Top Radio, there's no censor button. So.
Oh, great.
Wow.
If you were on my other radio show, we would have had, just have had a problem, but not so here.
Would have been, that would have been bleeped out.
Yeah. That, now you know why Brody likes to come to this radio show more than my other one.
Exactly. I can see the attraction.
Yeah.
Well, I actually have a couple of things to say
in response to what y'all have been talking about. Y'all, there we go.
I love it.
So, oh, no, she said it. Will, she said it.
I love it. That was very good. That's very natural.
It just came out. Speaking of empathy or sympathy for the Southerners. So a couple of things. First of all, regarding the superiority thing. I am a recovering alcoholic and addict, and in the program, or when I got clean and sober many years ago, 1980 actually, there was this terrific phrase that somebody taught me that I have never forgotten and really, I think, actually applies to the situation. In New York, they describe an alcoholic as somebody who can be lying in the gutter and still look down on people.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's kind of what you're describing.
Right.
So I kind of use that metaphor when I look at especially Southerners who don't have a whole lot of money. And actually, I also must say white Southerners. Because the way that I look at, you know, I too am a reporter, so I'm going to refer to the Williams Institute study on poverty, which was also done by the Center for American Progress. And one of the things that, that the scholar Gary Gates, a demographic guy, one of the things that he pointed out is that if you're talking about poverty in this country, and especially the importance of the discrimination in terms of employment, the group, of course you have transgender individuals, but the other group that's most at risk of poverty are African-American couples with children who live in the South. And then another also serious demographic are LGBT couples, Latino and Latina, in the Western states. So when I use the alcoholic metaphor, if you will, it's primarily the poor white guy in the pickup truck with the Confederate flag in the back and the gun in the rack that Howard Dean talked about reaching out to. So I bring that up because there must be a way to reach, you know, this group of people with a sense of commonality that kind of bypasses or acknowledges and then speaks to them in a more empathetic way, such as job discrimination. I don't know what that is. I'm not one of the LGBT leaders. I only report on them. But, you know, if we can talk to alcoholics and addicts to get them clean and sober and start a new and different and you know, hopeful life, then if we apply that metaphor to this kind of situation, there's got to be a language we can develop to talk to them. That's number one. The other thing that's very important to me about hate is empathy, because I was born actually at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. I've never been back. Alabama kind of scares me, to tell you the truth, albeit I understand it's very beautiful. At one point, I was going to apply for a job at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and somebody talked me out of it. So I'm fine where I am in West Hollywood. Thank you very much. But my father was a colonel in the Air Force, and we traveled all over the country. And one of the places where he was deputy base commander or something, was in Japan. And I was a little kid. And I was put on a school bus and driven off the base to go to kindergarten or first grade or something like that. And it was like the early 1950s. I want to say 54, 55, something like that. And outside, we were greeted by all these screaming Japanese college students. Yankee, go home! Yankee, go home! And they were scary. They were pissed off, and they were screaming at us, and they were scary. And we were little kids. And we were, and so I went back home, and I asked Risan, who was taking care of us, my brother and myself, you know, why do they hate me? What have I done? What, you know, what's wrong with me? What's going on? And Risan said, because you are occupiers in this country and they want their country back. So when we did wind up coming back to the mainland in the 50s, and I saw images on the television, television news of these young black kids trying to go to school, and everybody, all these angry white people were screaming at them. It hit my gut. I've been there. I knew exactly right. what they were, not exactly, of course, but my heart knew what they were going through. So it's this kind of empathy that when I started walking through the world as a little kid, and it's this whole thing about you have to be taught to love and to hate. When I was walking through the world and I saw people of color, you know, I had an automatic, albeit silent and, you know, whatever, but an identification. I was developing empathy. Nobody told me that. That's not, I didn't know it, but that, frankly, is one of the reasons that I wound up being a reporter, to be able to look at all of this and report on all of this. So empathy is also very important, and I would use that as a metaphor to associate with bullying. Anybody
right.
who has been, you know, the
yeah.
subject of bullying can understand that feeling, no matter black, white, or whatever. The third thing I want to talk about is something that you all were talking about earlier about education. I think Cynthia brought this up. I saw Hamilton last night, and not only was it an extraordinary musical and on and on and on about that, but I learned stuff. I learned that Alexander Hamilton was an abolitionist. I had no idea. Throughout the whole play, they kept referencing how Hamilton kept trying to get slavery, ended in, you know, the Federalist Papers and the founding documents and all this stuff. And frankly, he was rebuffed by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. And I mean, the woman with whom I went, who's a Politico, I mean, we literally at halftime pulled out her cell phone and looked this up. Alexander Hamilton, Revolutionary War, slavery, and there it is. Nobody taught me that in my history books.
Right.
I just learned that last night. So
my
reporting on my experience of Hamilton is going to now include that, which I haven't seen a whole lot of other reviews or discussions about Hamilton include. It also, there was a huge response to the immigrant line. We're immigrants. We get stuff done. And everybody, the police, this is the Pantages Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, opening night. Everybody exploded. We're a sanctuary city. It is apropos for what's going on here right now. So that education process in all these different venues is something that it's kind of our responsibility to carry forward. And so that's my diatribe. I'm sorry.
No, I related so much on so many of your points. You and I have so many parallels in our lives, and I won't go into those right now. But I wanted to elaborate on something that occurs to me based on what you guys have said so far. A lot of the emergence of these hate groups have been attributed, rightly so, to Donald Trump validating their almost acceptability on a public level for them to essentially come out. But one of the things, Cynthia, especially that you touched on, that is also occurring to me is that, I mean, not justifying this, but the fact that we had 8 years of a president that these people did not see as themselves any longer, that they related to him as somebody other than them, may have been the backup to the passion behind this. In other words, you know, it's like we're riding the pendulum between the, you know, the absolutely phenomenal thing that happened with our first African-American president to enraging and secretly hiding this passion in people who did no longer saw the person in that office as being like them. And they needed that, that they have this, and to Karen's point, almost like an alcoholic obsession with having to have that person look like them for them to feel okay about themselves. And then the permission from Donald Trump for them to come out. So my question to you all is this hate is now giving visibility. It potentially was already there. Is this better that it is now out where we can try to deal with it in face value, or was it better repressed and back in the closets where it was before?
Can
I had a conversation
follow up on something
earlier
on the
today,
south.
Will.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Will, go ahead. I've got something I wanted to tell the group because I had a conversation earlier today with Ryan Lentz and Heidi Brock at the Southern Poverty Law Center State Watch Project. But
yeah,
go ahead, Will, you first.
Let me just follow up with something about the South. I think it's I think it's okay to have empathy, but don't let us off the hook. We're not you know, because part of that I think feeds into the stereotype that Southerners just aren't quite as smart or sophisticated or worldly or knowledgeable or have access to that information than the rest of the country, and that's just not true. It's just we fight it harder. And I want to make sure that we don't point all of the fingers at the people at the rallies who are typically middle, lower class, right? Those aren't always the people that are causing the most problem. It's the
sure.
corporate VPs who you know, have policies where they are jacking up rates for black customers and lowering them for white customers. So it's much more systemic than that. And I don't want people to let us off the hook in the South, because we have the information in front of us, right? So much of the hatred for Obama was based on stuff that wasn't true, right? And it's people have taken that on as part of their belief system. I've heard so many times recently, well, you know, we put up with Obama for 8 years and you guys can put up with this. And my response is always, how did you suffer again? What were the things that went wrong in your life because of that? Right.
That's
so
right.
It's all based on some fantasy notion that they have of how horrible he was when the facts don't back that up. And so, yeah, don't let us off the hook just because we're slow to get it sometimes. That's my first thought.
Okay. I would agree with you too, Will, and I think what's made it a little kind of sort of confusing is, you know, who is a Southerner? I mean, my legal residence is in Knoxville, Tennessee. Do I consider myself a Southerner? No. You know, Karen said that she was born in Alabama. Does she consider herself from Alabama and a Southerner? I don't think she does based on her own description. So I think it's getting really hard to say, well, you're right. I mean, don't let us off the hook, but then who is us? You know, if you subscribe to a racist belief, but you're from, you know, you're born and raised in a blue state, well, you don't get let off the hook either. I mean, it's a belief system that's going to transcend a boundary or a generational ideal. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right, Cynthia. Let me give you guys what I was given today by the Southern Poverty Law Center. In conversations with Ryan Lentz, who's a senior investigative reporter for the Hate Watch Project, there are currently 917 hate groups operating in the United States. Now, this is material that's put together from the Alabama nonprofit, which tracks these groups. And they define a hate group as an organization with, quoting, beliefs or practices that attack or malign an entire class of people, typically for their immutable characteristics, whether it be racial or gender identity or sexual orientation, etc. Now, Ryan told me that they have been scouring the internet, they've been sending investigators out. And here's the ironic thing. Out of the 917 hate watch groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center is currently tracking, nearly half of those are in the Northeast and in the far West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the point that you made, Will, and the point that you made, Cynthia, I think is important. Rob, you had spoken earlier about the nice young whiny man that got busted. He was the one that was crying about going to get arrested. He's from New Hampshire, okay? Mm-hmm. I'd like to point out that in many cases, and Cynthia, you being a former special agent with the Bureau, you could probably verify this, but the vast majority of these folks are transient, and they have a tendency to cluster with like-minded individuals, whether it be Oregon, Nevada, New Hampshire, Vermont, or Foley, Alabama. I don't think it's necessarily fair to do an overarching characterization or generalization specific to. I think that, yes, there are things about, and I've traveled across the American South many, many times, that are, in fact, peculiar to, if you will, and Will, you and I have had this conversation many times before, to the South. But I think that overall, that we need to sound a more cautionary note, and I think we need to sound a generalized warning, about the fact that this is spreading. Yeah, I can't lay the blame on this on Trump's feet, and nor can I lay it on the blame of the rise of a lot of these groups during the Obama administration. But what I can point my finger at in this particular instance is the fact that the scab was pulled off by this particular president. I'm also going to add, in the conversations I had with the Southern Poverty Law Center and conversations that I've also had with the folks at Right Wing Watch, which is the People for the American Way, as well as the Center for American Progress in Washington, we need to take a harder look at what the real root cause of this is. Cynthia, of course, you work for the Shepherd Foundation. Well, in your position, and in Karen and I report on this, but there is a root level to this. It's very difficult to erase hate or to combat hate when you have people standing in pulpits every Sunday telling their congregation that it's God's will, and then these people that are carrying weapons and torches in places like Charlottesville, Virginia, also back that up. And this is evidence that's being presented to me by these nonprofits and by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Anybody care to comment?
Yeah, me. First of all, in terms of letting people off the hook, I don't want to let California off the hook either.
Right.
We have a place called Lancaster out here. We have these stretches of very conservative spots. I mean, not to forget that KKK's Tom Metzger was out of Southern California. He was sued out of his, that's how his particular KKK outfit ended. But I wanted to note that, there was a 6-foot monument, Confederate monument, in the famous Hollywood Forever Cemetery run by a gay guy,
mm-hmm.
Tyler Cassidy. And, I mean, nobody thought anything of it. It was just this Confederate, statue, and it was a tourist attraction, part of this Hollywood cemetery where all these famous celebs are buried. And it was actually discovered by the LA Times. They did an op-ed on it, and then people went, whoa, 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 wait a second, what? And there are Confederate soldiers who are not going to be, the monument has been removed, but the Confederate soldiers remain buried there. So I think that, it's all over the place. Regarding the religious right, I really want to thank you for that, because let's not forget that the Bible talks about the mark of Cain, and a lot of the religions look at the mark of Cain as skin color. And of course, we have our famous, you know, Leviticus, that is the excuse for people killing gay people.
Right.
So, you know, this is where it's going to get worse, is that if we have a greater extension of these so-called religious liberty laws, it's not only going to be, enable people by their religious rights of conscience to deny a public service, but additionally, they're going to start, if the Johnson Amendment is killed through the appropriations bill, which it seems on its way to do, that churches are going to start being able to endorse and fund political candidates. That means you're going to have dark money going into churches to fund candidates who espouse whatever the hell religious right crap they want to say. And that's all called freedom of speech under religious liberty. So the root of it is the roots are growing and getting stronger. And let's not forget that the Air Force Academy is in Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs has more churches, evangelical churches, and is home to Focus on the Family. So, you know, I know that the military is trying to root out and has specifically, all of the Joint Chiefs, all of the heads of the branches of the service have come out specifically and said, we do not tolerate extremism, hatred, bigotry, and all that. The Air Force guy was a little bit more tepid. But, you know, that's where a lot of them get training. So we need to keep our eye out for all of this. I know that they're keeping their eye out, too, but we need to as well.
Well, you may make some really good points, because the original arguments that were against even interracial marriage and a lot of mm-hmm. racial oppression were all, to your point, Bible-based. I mean, that's mm-hmm. why when we were fighting for marriage equality, we had a pattern, because we could go back and say, okay, here's how this was done before, this is how it's being done now, and it was bizarrely parallel. The one thing I want to ask you guys about, though, is the general population, because we'd like to think that this has been a wake-up call and Trump's base is shrinking somewhat, and even the press put out some numbers that were like, look what's happening. I looked at those numbers, and I see them a different way. And so I want to bounce them off you, and maybe it's me or maybe I'm right. But I don't see it shrinking enough. And 60% of the Republicans asked still support Trump. And even in independents, if you combine the ones who support Trump and the ones who don't have an opinion on his reaction to Charlottesville, it's 49%. That's still a heck of a lot of this country that is turning a cold shoulder onto this issue. I mean, am I missing something, or are we really still very far behind in our general population?
I just wanted to go back, if I could, and just comment on something Brody said, and then I'd like to just make one comment about your question.
Sure.
Regarding the Southern Poverty Law Center's tracking and watching hate groups, I'm a longtime fan and supporter of their work. But I think as a former FBI agent, what I would tell you is what I am more fearful of is the people that are living in their parents' basement who are not mm-hmm. subscribers to a hate group. I'm not so
yeah.
concerned about the 900 hate groups as I am what we term the lone wolves, who are mm-hmm. planning and plotting to do something horrible because they want to, because they were inspired by somebody and nobody knows who they are. So I'm more fearful about them. And in response mm-hmm. to your question about the statistics and the polls regarding what Trump said about Charlottesville, I'd go back to what Karen said. And it's I think the issue is not the numbers of who supports him and who doesn't. I think the issue is one of how do you change hearts and minds of Trump supporters?
Right.
I've got, as I'm sure we all do, a lot of family members that voted for him who are still supporting
mm-hmm.
him. And I'm not going to change their mind by arguing about what he said in response to Charlottesville or what he said in response to the Merck CEO leaving his business council. I'm not going to change hearts and minds that way. It's exactly what Karen said, is you have to find commonalities and common ground and empathy and talk to these supporters and try to figure out what's important to you. Is it healthcare? Is it jobs? Because I think that's the same thing that's important to me, and I bet you and I agree on a whole lot of things. But that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort. So every time I see polls about who supports him and who doesn't, I just keep thinking we all collectively on the side of the country that did not support him and vote for him, we need to reach out to his supporters and try to slowly, methodically, and patiently find out why they voted for him and what it's going to take that support away.
Right.
Let me take that from Cynthia, and let me tell that to Will. Will, you are literally on the front lines. You and I have talked about this. Your center, right there in Memphis, between your kids from Hurt Village and your kids from the other side of Memphis, I mean, it's the color thing, it's the trans thing, it's what Cynthia just said, it's what Karen has said, it's what you and I have talked about so many times in private conversations on the phone. Talk about that for just a second, because you literally, you're on the front lines. You're sitting right there commanding troops. Give me
your thoughts. I have a couple of thoughts. The first one that pops into my head is that this new administration hasn't been as stark a change for us in the South as it might be for people around the country. This is just an extension or an evolution of what we experience all the time. It's not a sea change, because we have elected officials that say this sort of stuff all the time, you know, that when we try to get non-discrimination ordinances passed, call us perverts and child molesters, like, to our faces in public meetings. So this kind of dynamic is not new for us. It's just how everybody's getting to experience it on a larger scale, right? But I also think
your world.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I called some of my friends who run centers around the country, you know, in L.A. and New York and in Chicago, and that's basically what I said to them. I said, now you're in our world, and I hate that for you, but here you are.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thought is about how difficult it is to change people's minds. I think there's a parallel between support for Trump and that authoritarian build a wall, ban people from coming in, all those sorts of things that he's doing, and this belief system that the troubles in my life are caused by somebody else. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's because that person took my job, or because these people get special privileges, or these people want a special, you know, dispensation or whatever. The trouble in my life is caused by somebody else taking something that belongs to me. And so as long as he's spouting that kind of rhetoric, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of change in his support patterns, because they're not upset when he talks about black people, and they're not upset when he talks about Muslims. Those are not the things that upset them. It's going to be if he doesn't get, you know, some sort of jobs bill passed, or if they're not going to get that job they expected to get, when it actually hits them in the pocketbook, I think it might actually be something meaningful. But the rhetoric right now is that's who they voted for. Why would they change? Why would they change, you know, horses in midstream? So I think it's much more intractable than we like to believe, because it feeds into their kind of already established belief system about why things are the way they are.
Right, which is an ironic pattern of voters. One thing that isn't talked about a lot about the last election, which I personally think did have an effect on the outcome, was the fact that healthcare costs under Affordable Health Care Act went up in October right before the election. So people were getting their health care bills, and, you know, it became very tight and personal, even though it wasn't necessarily rational, you know, in terms of their reaction. But that, you know, with the razor thinness of the election, that could have swayed as much as any of the other factors that get discussed. I wanted to shift gears a little bit because of some of the theme that we brought up in the overview of this show, and the fact that we only have 10 minutes left. But Ben Carson came out and was completely in support of everything that Donald Trump had said. He's great. You know, people are making too much of this, blah, blah, blah. You know, as a, you know, African-American man standing up, and we know his philosophy, so it wasn't a big surprise, but it was still a little shocking that somebody who is essentially a target of the hatred could just turn such a blind eye to it. My question is, do we have a faction of the LGBTQ community who is the same way, who are part of this hate wave, even though they are LGBTQ themselves?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably should ask that in a more open-ended way. Okay, yeah.
I don't want to hang around any of your friends, because my answer is no. I don't know of any personally. I don't want to hang around Will's friends or anyway.
Yeah, no, you don't.
You don't.
I know some LGBT people who support Trump, and they do it from a business perspective. I mean, I can argue that, you know, his bankruptcy.
Right, that's exactly right.
I can argue all this stuff till I'm blue in the face, and they still see his name on these buildings, even though that's farmed out, you know, it's a franchise. And they think of him as somebody that they can aspire to be. You know, and they, you know, all that crap that he was putting out during the campaign, you know, he just with a little bit of money from his father, he was able to do this, that, and the other, and now he's a billionaire and blah, blah, blah. Have you ever heard of the Emoluments Clause? No, what's that? Never mind. Okay. I mean, it's like, it's that. It's, there is something that he conveyed during the campaign that was kind of like inspirational for people. If I did this, if these are my beliefs, you can do it too. And the other thing is that let's not forget the Omarosa factor. I mean, you know, there really are a lot of blacks and black evangelicals in particular. The evangelical community has not deserted this guy. You know, he's three times married. Talks about pussies on, you know, Access Hollywood, the whole shebang. They forgive, they forgive, they forgive. And, I don't know what they see in him, but they're still sticking with him. And the business, LGBT business guys are still sticking with him. It was, you know, he seems to be like a role model in some way, shape, or form, no matter what facts you present.
I think that's true for a lot of people that I know, too. I certainly know a lot of people that were in the military that have been supportive of him and the business aspect, too. But I still see lots of comments from people, from especially gay white men, who are hard to distinguish from people from hate groups. Talking about the blacks and talking about, you know, I mean, using the word mongrel. I mean, just like really horrible stuff from white gay men that I know. And I don't think it's all, you know, I don't think it's all the business stuff, and it's not all the military stuff. There's a strain of this just intolerance from people who should know better because of their own experience.
That's racist.
Well, I think that's
not,
true.
Not just intolerance,
I mean,
that's racist.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true, but when you're looking at situations and you talk about certain sects, okay, like log cabin Republicans, for example, now you're talking about predominantly white privileged gay people, okay, and Karen's point was taken in terms of business and money, and when it comes down to progressive social views in terms of women reproductive rights, immigrant rights, Muslim rights, even black rights, there becomes a disconnect. And so the Achilles heel there for at least that part of the gay community is the racism within the gay community. We have seen, you know, these examples before in terms of the transgender community. But, you know, it's something that the gay community in general is going to have to address. It is racism, pure and simple. You can't walk it back just because they're part of the LGBTQI, you know, acronym as part of the community. And I think that that's something that we need to address.
No, absolutely. It makes sense, actually, because of all the factors you all have pointed out in the show that has created this, that somebody, just because their sexual orientation is apart from being heterosexual, or their gender identity is apart from being cisgender, doesn't make them immune from the same factors that you described that are creating the problem in the first place. So it would almost be bizarre that there wouldn't be some of us in that group. We've got 5 minutes left, and I really want to get your crystal balls out, especially, you know, those of you who are in touch with kind of the inner workings of things. What is going to happen with Donald Trump now? John Kelly looked like he was going to throw up as he listened to his boss. You know, they're less friends of his on the public level, even if the public, his core isn't eroding fast enough, but there's still, you know, the power structure is turning on him quickly. What is going to happen? Will he be president 3 weeks from now?
I've got sources in Washington telling me that we may, in fact, be looking at a presidential exit, and that a deal will be made with Pence in terms of pardons and other considerations. Now, whether or not that's true or just wishful thinking is anybody's guess. However, some of the signs are in place there. The Director Mueller, the special counsel, and his grand jury, along with sources inside the FBI, who have told me that they're putting things together in such a way that at least business associates of the president and the president himself more than likely are probably going to find themselves under true bill of indictment by that federal grand jury. So I honestly truly believe an exit is coming. I don't know if it'll be in the next 3 months, but I think it'll be before the end of the year.
And should that happen, are we better off under a Mike Pence presidency, and will he make the this hate wave go away or put it back in the shadows? What do you think?
Pence has been standing next to Trump like a good Christian wife who's subject to her husband. I mean, if you look at the way he looks at Trump, I mean, the image is there of being the good Christian subjugated wife. Pence is the reason that the transgender ban thing was tweeted out. Pence is a horror. But Pence also said that he stood by Trump's comments, you know, including the last news conference. So he's going to be a horror to deal with, albeit the people in Congress think they know him from his prior time there. And so they're going to be, you know, oh, my God, wipe the brow. You know, we're over and done with this Trump guy. Pence is so much better. He's a reasonable guy. He is an evangelical Catholic is the way he describes himself. He is so deeply religious that all that stuff we were talking about earlier, that's going to come to play as policy. And he's going to figure out a way to finesse it through language and get it through Congress. He's scary. Now, is Paul Ryan even better than him? Well, say goodbye to Medicare and Social Security and everything else with Paul Ryan. So 2018 is the big move.
Well, Karen, thank you for that. I'm gonna let you have had the last point on that. We have literally a minute and a half left, but I will actually jump back to one thing that you alluded to because I have a similar background. Is anybody have 1 minute worth of burning desire of a point that needs to be made on this?
This statue battle down here with Nathan Bedford Forrest trying to get the statue removed in a predominantly African-American city. And so one of the things we're talking a lot about is erasing history. And, you know, the point that a lot of us are trying to make is that we're not going to forget what he did just because his face is not in front of ours, right? Timothy McVeigh does not have a statue in Oklahoma City. They don't forget what he did. We don't need to have the statue to remember the horror.
Right.
There you go.
Statues are not history. I mean, Stephen Colbert actually did a wonderful thing on The Late Show about that. That was brilliant about, you know, we would only remember Lincoln because he sat in a big chair if statues were history, and that isn't the case. So I want to thank you all for joining tonight. I really want each and every one of you back again so we can have more time to talk about all sorts of things, including this. I have like 50 more questions that I did not ask, just to let you know how we barely scratched the surface with your brilliance. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Also listen to Out in Santa Cruz, KSEO.com. That's Saturday night at 7 p.m. We have another take on LGBTQ rights. Again, thank you for joining us. Come back next week, Thursday, same bat channel, same bat time, and we will have another interesting show for you then.